Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of man was Aaron Burr, and how did his personal joys and sorrows align with the passion and personality he brought to his public life? Burr is remembered today for his ruthless and perhaps treasonous ambition and for his deadly accurate aim at the 1804 duel that killed political rival Alexander Hamilton. But surviving personal correspondence, especially between Burr and his beloved only daughter Theodosia, revealed that he could also be funny, generous, and tender, and that his views on women's rights put him far ahead of his time. Here to talk about this fascinating but infamous American is H.W. Brands. He is Dixon Allen Anderson Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. He's in town to speak to the DMA's Arts and Letters Live tonight. H.W., welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for that wonderful introduction. I couldn't have done it better myself.
Well, good. What made you want to write about Burr's? We know so much about his political life, but what drew you to his personal life?
A couple of things. One is that I think the scoundrels of history are always much more interesting to write about than the heroes. Mm-hmm. And anybody who was as despised as Burr was by characters across the political spectrum, from John Adams to Alexander Hamilton to Thomas Jefferson, I thought there's somebody I need to know more about. The other thing was, well, there are two more things. One is that it turns out that there is this surviving correspondence.
Yeah.
And it's a correspondence that is very personal. We have Thomas Jefferson's papers. We have George Washington's papers. But those tend not to be so personal. They tend to be more about business, about politics, about the affairs of public life. But with Burr, we have this correspondence between Burr and his daughter, Theodosia Burr, who is a remarkable woman, one of the most remarkable women of her day. And to see Burr's relationship with his daughter, to see it develop as she grew older, was fascinating to me. I have written about the public figures of American life for some years now, and the public figures of American life almost all happen to be men. And I have been looking for women to write about. And Theodosia Burr was not a public figure, but her father was. And the relationship between the two allowed me to develop her character, her historical character, and to examine Burr through his relationship with his daughter. And then the last thing was, and I have to be careful that I don't give away the ending too much, that there's this heartbreaking tragedy at the end of the story. And when I heard this part of the story, I said, oh my gosh, what a story. It's a haunting ending to the whole thing.
You draw on this treasure trove of personal correspondence, and what's really interesting is that it continues throughout, they called her Theo, throughout Theo's right. life, her father is still educating her.
Because Burr was one of the first people of his generation, really maybe of American history, to believe that the intelligence of women was fully equal to that of men, Theo became something of his personal project to demonstrate that this was indeed true. He was one of the earliest advocates of women's rights, of women's equality. And he also was very well read, very well educated himself, and he believed that he could be the best educator of his daughter. And this was partly by the correspondence they had. Now, of course, there was a lot that went on just face-to-face, but we historians, and this is, I mean, I'm writing a work of history, not a novel, so I don't get to fill in the blanks with my imagination. And so one of the things that makes the story work for me as a historian is the fact that Burr often traveled. And when he traveled, his way of communicating with his daughter was by correspondence, by letters. If he had been a stay-at-home father, he might well have spent more time tutoring Theo himself, but that all would have been lost to history. And so I wouldn't have been able to tell the story, and it's critical. And it's fascinating to watch Theo mature in her letters, and he naturally at first addresses her as one would address a six-year-old, that's when she was six. But as she gets older, the level of the conversation in the letters matures. Until really by the time she's 15 or so, she's writing to him almost as an equal. And It's an interesting relationship, and it became more a relationship of equals after her mother, his wife, died of cancer when she was 11 years old. And so he never, well, at least as long as she was around, he didn't remarry. He eventually remarried after she had left. But so she became the hostess of his mansion in Manhattan. Richmond Hill was the name of it. And it sat roughly where the Manhattan end of the Holland Tunnel is today. But this was in the suburbs. This was out in the country. Mm-hmm. And so Theo became the hostess. She became the first lady of this mansion. And even when he was not around, she would hold dinner parties and the high society of New York would come to her home. And everyone would remark on the amazing maturity, self-possession of this remarkable young woman.
So the relationship that Aaron Burr had with Theo's mother, also named Theodosia, was interesting as well, especially because even in those days, it didn't look like the sort of marriage that people had or that was considered advantageous.
That's exactly right. Burr was a dashing officer in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. And he was known as something of a Romeo. He had had lady friends. But he met and fell in love with Theodosia, who was the widow of a British Army officer. Now, this might have seemed sort of treasonous because the Revolutionary War was on, but the deceased husband, he was dead, and Burr wasn't going to hold the loyalties of his girlfriends now and his fiancées deceased against her. She was, to put it honestly, she wasn't all that attractive, nor was she rich. You know, if you were a woman in the late 18th century and you expected to catch an up-and-coming, a promising, handsome, ambitious, talented person, it really helped you a lot to be either beautiful or, even better, rich. Hmm. And she was neither. But Burr clearly fell in love with her. And I think he fell in love with her mind as much as with the rest of her. And here was a woman that he could speak to as an equal. And so it wasn't really very surprising that he should choose, and the mother cooperated entirely, to raise their daughter the way they did, because she was intelligent, she was well-educated, and so their daughter ought to be educated and well and intelligent as well.
So his political career gets underway. He begins to have some success, but he's sort of a disaster with money. I mean, all along throughout his life, he has, sort of a good home life and yet a lot of personal problems. And then, of course, he's quite the scrapper in public life.
Burr was one of those individuals who might have been too charming for his own good, because when people met him face to face, they had great difficulty not being persuaded, not being charmed by him, sometimes against their better judgment.
Including Alexander Hamilton.
Including Alexander Hamilton, yeah. And he also was ambitious in the way that Hamilton was ambitious, in the way that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, that people are ambitious. And he was very adept. He was a brilliant lawyer. And so he, in fact, began his public life, aside from his service as an officer, as a lawyer. And he developed a very promising practice, and people said that, you know, he should consider politics. It was probably more automatic that someone like Burr would go into politics in those days than that someone would today. It's worth remembering that American society was very much smaller then. So, for example, the entire population of the United States was not that much greater than the population of Dallas today. Mm-hmm. And so everybody knew everyone else. And if you were a successful lawyer, then people that you did business with who frequented your practice, who had political views, and they all had political views, because this was the generation, of course, that was creating the United States of America. And Burr was one of those who had fought for American independence. And it seemed to behoove those people who fought for independence to then be involved in the construction of the new government. Because it was one thing to win independence, but then, that's almost like tearing down the house, the old British Empire, and now somebody's got to build the new house. And so Burr got involved in this. He was very good at what he did. He was very good at persuading people to join him politically. And he threw in his lot with the newly emerging, well, it was then called the Republican Party, but it's the ancestor of the modern Democratic Party. It was Thomas Jefferson's party. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of party politics, and in fact, this is a sub-theme of the book, the difficulties of the emergence of American politics. Because at the very beginning, in the days of the Revolution, and for a few years after that, political parties were considered to be a blight on the American landscape. Those people, those men who fought for American independence, they identified parties with the bad practices and behavior, with the corruption of British politics. And they believed that in a republic where political power would rest on the people, parties would not be necessary. In fact, parties would be a bad thing because parties were institutions that took the interests of the party ahead of the interests of the nation as a whole.
Let me stop you there. Yeah. And we will take a quick break and we will pick up on that thread in just a moment. My guest is H.W. Brands, author of the new book, The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. If you would like to read this fascinating new book, you can receive a copy of it with our thanks when you make a $120 contribution or more to 1-888-694-6931 or you go online to kera.org. Jeff Whittington is here, senior producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. I want to thank Patricia Smith and Keller Gregory and Hedda Hahn in Dallas, Ron Berger in Dallas, Milton Northway, who called or joined online from Fort Worth. Thanks also to E.A. Bernius and Roland Gutierrez in Dallas, and Catherine and Michael Greenberg in Dallas.
Your contribution will add to that amount that they have raised for the station. We have $19,990. That's kind of a cool figure, but one that we don't want to stick at for very long. Left to raise. We would love to do it by 2 o'clock. Your contribution in any amount will help us out. Maybe you're ready to make a friends level contribution that would really take a bite out of this amount that we have to raise. You can do it now, receive a lot of special benefits, and you can set that up with a sustaining membership and pay it out at just $125 a month, should you so choose.
Yeah, just call 888-694-6931 and make your contribution, or go online to kera.org and do it there. Because a longtime listener and a fan of KERA has contributed $2,000 today. This started this morning, Chris, to challenge listeners to contribute $29,000 by 2 p.m. Help us meet this challenge and honor this generous gift with a gift of your own. Well, we've made great progress. Just $19,900 left to go on this goal. We're not quite to the place where that's all that's left in the campaign just yet, but that's what our goal is by 2 o'clock today, $19,990. Just call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
Thank you so much, Mr. and Mrs. Bill Metz of Dallas, Alexis Honda and Scott Carita in Fort Worth. Thank you, Duncan Edwards and Melissa Ogden in Dallas. Your contribution can be next. You can join us. We would love to read your name. We would love to send you a copy of The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. Your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 can make it happen.
$19,510 left in our goal by 2 p.m. Be the next one to call, 888-694-6931. $2,000 challenge in play to try to raise $19,510 by 2 o'clock. Go online to kera.org and make your contribution there.
Think about all the things you know because of public radio, all the things you have to discuss with your friends, with your colleagues on a regular basis because you listen to this station either over the air or online, and then make a contribution. You can do that online at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands, Dixon Allen Anderson Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I love thinking about this period in history because we think back to the founding fathers and sort of assume that they had it all planned out and they just had to execute. But in fact, you remind us this was not the case, even as it came to the establishment or not of political parties.
Well, in fact, this is one of the things that I bring up with my students all the time because when I teach undergraduates and graduate students as well, and I consider that history is sort of a subset or a complement to civics, mm-hmm. and I try to encourage them to participate. But very often, people, including my students, think that all the big decisions have been made and all the structures are there. But if I can take them back to a time when these structures, when these decisions were being made, I can remind them that every generation creates its own present and future. And the Burr story, it allows me to tell that story. And I will confess, this is the title is The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. And the centerpiece is the relationship of Burr with his daughter, Theo. But this is also a way of kind of bootlegging in the history of the time. Because Burr was this character who would not – you wouldn't have found Burr if he had come along 50 years later mm-hmm. because the institutions by then had largely taken shape. They had congealed. And – one of the centerpieces of the story, of my story, is Burr's duel with Alexander Hamilton. Well, people today often despair that politics is low and dirty and mean, but we haven't had any deadly duels in years.
Yeah.
So how bad can they be? But in the case of Burr's duel with Hamilton, it was both an indication that these political institutions were fluid. The parties were forming, and neither man, neither Burr nor Hamilton, was really a good fit, even in 1804 when the duel took place. They were individuals whom history had almost gone past mm-hmm. because the reason for the duel, it started in individual insult that escalated. But what prompted each man to issue and then accept the challenge was a knowledge that their political careers had peaked and that they had spent the better part of their young lives trying to gain independence for the United States, and they had laid a foundation of these two major political parties, Hamilton with the Federalists, who would be, after a couple of changes, the antecedents of the modern Republican Party, and Burr for the Jeffersonian Republicans, which would be the Democrats. But in each case, each man had been sort of elbowed out of the party, partly because they didn't exactly know how to play party politics. They were sort of Washingtonians. George Washington famously believed that parties would be the ruin of America. And he had sufficient stature that he could remain above parties. But Burr and Hamilton did not. But they didn't know exactly how to play the parties. And so they found themselves relatively in the prime of life. They were in their 40s and they had futures ahead of them, but not like the futures they had projected for themselves. So Hamilton realized that his career had peaked and his own party, the Federalists, didn't want anything to do with him. And Burr was being pushed aside by Jefferson and the Republicans. And so it set them up to want to regain something of the respect in which they had been held. And it was in an age when dueling was one of the ways that people did this. And it was a tragedy, of course, that Hamilton wound up dead as a result of the duel. But that was the nature of personal life. That was the nature of politics.
Talk about this, because my understanding is often when these duels were fought, there was a sort of gentleman's understanding that everybody would miss, that you would keep your honor intact. Is there any sense whatsoever that Burr imagined he might miss?
There's no indication that Burr went into the duel intending to miss, planning to miss. And there's no indication ahead of the fact that Hamilton was going to do the same. Each man assumed that the other was trying to kill him. Mm-hmm. And that was the point of the duel. Now, in many cases, the seconds, the assistants, would come along and try to talk one or the other out of it and say that, okay, honor has been assuaged. You know, you realize you've demonstrated that you're willing to stand up for your honor. But and that often worked when one or the other really didn't want to do it, mm-hmm. but sort of felt they had to. But in this case, both of them realized, well, both of them believed that they had to do something to regain what they were losing. And each one was sufficiently prominent. Each one had enough of a reputation that neither one thought they could afford to lose the reputation. So neither one was going to back down. And it was Hamilton's misfortune that he was the one who got killed.
Of course, the irony is it was also Burr's misfortune because his political career was essentially blown up. He remained in office as vice president, but he was never back in Washington. Is that right?
Well, he did go back to Washington, despite the fact that there was a murder charge hanging over his head in New York and New Jersey. But as long as he was vice president, he was largely immune from prosecution. Mm-hmm. But the irony of this is that the man that he killed, Alexander Hamilton, had long been associated with the Federalist Party. Burr was a Republican, a Jeffersonian Republican. And one might have thought that that would cause his own party to embrace him the more. But in fact, the subtext of all of this was that Thomas Jefferson really knew how to play hardball politics, despite the fact that he liked to portray himself as this philosopher king type, this philosopher president who really didn't want to get his hands dirty. Well, he knew how to play the game. And he was quite willing to accept Burr's help in getting elected. Burr was crucial in bringing New York onto the side of the Republicans in the 1800 election. But Jefferson had no intention of letting Burr be his successor. Jefferson wanted to keep the presidency in the hands of the Virginians. So George Washington of Virginia had been the first president. There was this anomaly with John Adams, who had been elected. But then Jefferson was a Virginian. He had two terms. He was already grooming his successor, James Madison, who would groom his successor, James Monroe. And Burr would have spoiled this. So Jefferson was figuring out how to elbow Burr aside. And that was really the critical thing. And it wasn't his killing in the duel of Hamilton that ended Burr's political career. It was Jefferson's decision that was independent of that, that Burr had to be pushed aside.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Roy in Fort Worth. Hi, Roy.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, I've heard the author mention a couple of times that Aaron Burr didn't like political parties because he was afraid that politicians would become more in debt to the parties and to their constituents. They would identify and vote more in the interest of the parties. And I was wondering what he thought about the state of political parties today and the apparent, fruition or the coming true of his fears.
There's no question that political parties became institutions. We've always had two of them. That most of the founders, certainly in their early days, would have thought was a very bad influence on American politics for precisely the reason that you identify, that parties develop interests as parties. And so very often it appears that the parties are putting the interests of the parties ahead of the interests of the country as a whole. And so if Burr could come back to life today, he would probably say, yeah, that's exactly what I was afraid of. And George Washington would too. It's interesting to imagine what Thomas Jefferson would say about this kind of thing, because Jefferson always maintained in his rhetoric that parties were a bad thing. But nonetheless, Jefferson was the first and one of the most effective party bosses in American political history.
How did Burr get it in his head that he would start his own country?
It's still unclear.
Because he wasn't insane, right?
Intended. No, he wasn't insane at all. What did Burr actually imagine that he would do when he went on those Western journeys? And for the listeners who don't know the story, just basically, Burr went off to the Southwest And in those days, the Southwest meant Louisiana. Mm-hmm. New Orleans had just been added. The Louisiana Purchase had just been added. Burr, like very many people, believed that it would be difficult for this now very much larger Union to hold together, especially in that day before steamboats, before railroads. And so once you cross the Appalachian Mountains, let's say traveling from the Atlantic coast, once you cross the Appalachian Mountains, it was all downhill to Louisiana. And that was literally true because all the rivers drained that way. And there were very many people, Burr among them, who believed that inevitably the gravitational pull, literally of gravity, would draw the West away from the East because it was very difficult and time-consuming to travel from even a place like Cincinnati to New York City because you had to cross the mountains and you had to go upstream. Everything traveled, big stuff traveled by water, and it all went downstream. So Burr suspected that there might well be an independent future for the West. Whether he intended to cause that to happen or whether he simply intended to benefit from its happening on its own is unclear. One of the things he definitely did want to do was to get involved in a war with Mexico. Well, Spain controlled Mexico in those days. Because Burr was among very good company, including Andrew Jackson and nearly everybody who lived in the Southwest, in believing that Spain was frustrating the ambitions of the United States to expand. So what Burr had in mind was what actually happened under the auspices of Andrew Jackson and then of Sam Houston. Burr imagined that Spain could be attacked by Americans living in the Southwest and at least part of its territory fashioned into a new republic. Well, that's exactly what Texas became, and Texas was a republic. And so Burr lived long enough to appreciate the irony, and Burr did have a finely tuned sense of irony, to appreciate the irony of the fact that Sam Houston and Stephen Austin and the Texas independence movement were praised for doing pretty much what he had attempted to do and had been tried for treason in doing 20 years earlier. And Burr, of course, would have pointed out, yeah, he was tried for treason, but he was acquitted.
My guest is H.W. Brands. He's Dixon Allen Anderson, professor of history at UT and author of The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. We'll come back to our discussion in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. If you would like to read a copy of The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr by H.W. Brands, we do have copies available as thank you gifts with a contribution of $120 or more. You can make yours online at kera.org. or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Our goal of $29,000 that started during the Diane Rehm Show today by 2 p.m., we're down to $19,510 left to go. You can call right now, 888-694-6931, or you can click and join online at kera.org. The reason we take these breaks is because we have treaded and stepped, we've crossed the line into that zone that I try to avoid. But, you know, honestly, we thought the drive would be over by now.
That's, you couldn't schedule a guest this awesome during fundraising.
Right, right. I mean, because people don't want to miss a single moment of the show. So that's why we're taking the break, to give you a minute to call, to give you a minute to go online. Because, you know, it is to our peril that we schedule an interesting topic and interesting guest like Professor H.W. Brands on the show when we are trying to fundraise, because you just wait for the show to continue.
But right now it's just Jeff and me, so
that's
you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, so call. Please, you know, don't listen to us. Grab the phone. Well, listen to us and then grab the phone and call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. The thing about pledging online and contributing online is you can still listen while you're filling in the form, because it's kind of like ordering jeans or something, or running shoes, or crushed ice, or something on the internet.
Exactly.
Trying to think of all the things that we like.
We don't get crushed ice. 1-888-694-6931 is the number if you'd rather call. But yes, online at kera.org. Not only can you make your contribution, set up a membership, but you can also check out thank you gifts, including the Heartbreak of Aaron Burr, including the book from our first hour guest, My Two Moms. But if there's something else you've heard about and you've been waiting for it to come up again, it's all there. You just have to look for it online. So please don't hold off.
You know, that new John Irving book. John Irving's going to be in studio next Tuesday on the show, yes. By the way, folks. And he was on the Diane Rehm show this morning, and we're offering that new John Irving novel as a thank you gift as well. So all kinds of different ways that you can ask us to thank you. But you have to ask us before we can thank you, and that means making a contribution. So please, please do it right now.
That's why we have to ask you for your contribution.
That's right.
So the reason that we have, you might be wondering why we keep talking about this $29,000 by 2 o'clock and the $19,000 left to go. Longtime listener and fan of the station has contributed $2,000 to challenge KERA listeners to raise $29,000 by 2 o'clock. I'm curious about the $29,000 figure, but it's just intriguing.
It must get us somewhere. It must get us to some sort of easily communicable, you know, goal. We can communicate. We can spread the goal.
This, yes, exactly.
We can spread the word about the goal. Yeah, very, very easily once we get there. So.
Thank you so much, Cynthia Gates in Azle, for your contribution, and Jeanette Preston in Plano. Join those fine ladies and make your contribution now. You'll feel great. You can choose a thank you gift if you want to, and still have money left over for crunchy ice and running shoes.
888-694-6931. And sorry, this is my melt. This is my typical meltdown break.
You've been here since 6 a.m.
The member drive.
I know. This is always when we lose you.
Or go online to KERA.org. And don't forget, you can pick up a copy of H.W. Brand's new book, The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr, when you join the station with a $120 contribution. He's speaking at Arts and Letters Live tonight at the DMA. I'm sure they'll have copies there as well. The book is available. It's out. We're just trying to give you some sort of incentive to get you to make that call, to come on over and make your contribution and join KERA. Become more than just a public radio listener here in North Texas. Become a public radio listener who also contributes and helps make this station a possibility and a reality.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or KERA.org. Great thing about supporting KERA is that this is a community institution. The folks who work here live here. Of course, we bring in programming from around the country and around the world, but there is a great deal of local production just for the North Texas community, not least of which is this show and on Fridays, Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. These shows are available to you because of your support.
$19,510 left in this challenge period. Oh, about 20 minutes to do it. It is doable. We know there are thousands of you listening right now, and we just really just need you to make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or on the web at kera.org. Please do it now. Please don't wait. And thank you so much for your support.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He's Dixon Allen Anderson Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, H.W., what did Theo think about her father's exploits during this time that we were just discussing?
It's a little bit hard to know in detail what Theo was thinking about, in part because not all the letters survive, in part because Burr himself didn't fill in Theo on everything that he was doing. For example, he didn't tell her that he was about to have this duel with Alexander Hamilton for fear that she would be alarmed, and she was far away. She was now living in South Carolina and married, and there wasn't anything she could do about it at this point. He did, however, write her what was, in effect, a farewell letter in case he should be the one who would die as a result of the duel. And so she was aware of his general circumstance. He did brief her on politics a lot. In fact, he considered her to be one of his most important informants and counselors on politics. He would use her as a sounding board. He would tell her how politics were going in New York, what he was trying to accomplish, what he managed to accomplish. But she had actually married into a political family in South Carolina, so she appreciated that. He did have some concern, however, that people were reading his mail. And postmasters in those days, before civil service, were appointed by the government, by the executive branch. And this is one of the reasons that political parties caught on because the political party that held the White House controlled the federal civil service. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was mostly postmasters and customs agents. And when Burr had his falling out with Thomas Jefferson, he understood that Jefferson's appointees in the post office might well be reading his mail. Nonetheless, he and Theo kept up a correspondence on matters political, literary, artistic, on the raising of children. By now, she had a son. Mm-hmm. And Burr was quite enamored of his grandson, who was named for him, yes. And the fact that his daughter and grandson now lived far away, South Carolina, and he was in New York City or traveling around the West. And in those days, that was, in effect, much farther than it is today.
How long did it take a letter, by the way, to get back and forth?
It depended. A letter from New York to South Carolina could easily take 3 weeks going and another 3 weeks coming back. There weren't regular mail schedules the way there are today. And so a lot of it depended on the haphazardness of the weather. And if you were traveling from South Carolina to New York, the obvious way to go would be by sea. And you'd get on board a sailing vessel and off you'd go. But if the winds weren't fair, if you encountered a storm, then it might take quite a while. And so very often the letters will have either Burr or Theo complaining to the other, I haven't heard from you for weeks. You know, why don't you write? And they had written, mm-hmm. but the letter had gotten waylaid. And people had to be just much more patient in communications in those. And they had to live more in their imagination. So they would remember, you know, what somebody looked like. Theo made a number of trips to New York, in part because she wanted to see her father, in part because South Carolina in the summer was an unhealthy place to live. And people who lived there tried to get out of South Carolina. Nobody knew exactly what caused diseases like malaria and yellow fever. It was before the discovery of the mechanism of infectious disease. But they did know that people who stayed in the lowlands, places like Charleston, South Carolina, during the summer, they tended to get sick and they tended to die. And so for her to come north during the summer was considered a good thing for her and, of course, for her father as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's see. We've got lots of calls on the line. Let's go to Charlie in Lakewood. Hey, Charlie.
Hi. A few years ago, a charity was organized and they decided to auction replicas of Hamilton's dueling pistols. And they sent them to an expert to replicate the pistols. And he was amazed to find a secret method of converting the normal trigger to a hair trigger, which would obviously be an advantage to the owner of the pistols. And he could actuate a hair trigger, which would improve, theoretically improve his marksmanship. And the speculation is that Hamilton actuated his hair trigger, but was nervous and prematurely fired it to his detriment.
What do you know about that, H.W.?
It's clear that Hamilton's shot went awry, and he did get off the first shot. It's unclear that a hair trigger would have been an obvious advantage, because a lot of people today have a misconception of what duels were like in the early 18th century. They weren't the Wild West quick draw kind of things. Each participant got one shot, and sometimes the individuals chose to let the other person shoot first, because then you could take your time and you could, you know, make very clear that you would hit the other person. Sometimes you would shoot first. If you were really confident of your marksmanship, then you would shoot first. But the trouble with that is that if you did shoot first, you had to hit your opponent either in the brain or in the heart. You pretty much had to kill him right away. If you hit him anywhere else, then you had to wait, stand your ground while the opponent could take aim at you. And if an opponent wanted to kill you at the surest way on that second shot, would aim not for the head or for the heart, but for the gut. Because if you got hit in the intestines, you almost certainly would develop an infection. You might hemorrhage immediately and die, or you'd develop an infection that would kill you. And that's, in fact, what killed Alexander Hamilton. There's a lot of speculation about Hamilton. Did he intend to waste his shot? Did the shot go awry? Needless to say, he didn't survive to tell us exactly what he intended.
What kind of relationship did Aaron Burr have with his son-in-law?
Aaron Burr's son-in-law became the governor of South Carolina. And it was very clear that Theo was probably respected and loved her father more in certain ways than she loved her husband. It must have grated on her husband that the son was named not for him, but for her father, and that the son was going to be raised not really as an Alston, that was his name, but as a Burr. And it was also very clear that Theo wanted to see her father whenever she could. However, having said that, Aaron Burr was forced into exile after the duel with Hamilton, after the treason trial from which he was acquitted. Nonetheless, he was forced into exile. And when he came back home, he wanted dearly to see his daughter. But she couldn't leave immediately because she couldn't travel without her husband. And her husband was involved in a difficult campaign for governor of South Carolina. So she did remain loyal to her husband that way. But when finally the opportunity arose, and he couldn't leave, so Burr sent a man of his own to go fetch her. A woman didn't travel by herself and didn't bring along a child, except at her peril. So Burr sent his own man to go get her, and it was that ended in the great tragedy of Aaron Burr's life.
We won't discuss it this afternoon because of your request, although folks can certainly find this out, but yeah, Hopefully they'll read this book. But talk a little bit about this. I mean, did you like Aaron Burr? Did you think, do you hit your head with the palm of your hand and say, come on? I mean, how did you feel about him as a person?
I think Aaron Burr would have been a fascinating person to know, to have dinner with. He was a wonderful conversationalist. I don't know that I would have trusted Aaron Burr with an important aspect of my life, with my finances. I don't know that I wouldn't have.
You don't want him as your accountant, is what you're
saying.
Well,
I don't know that I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
I took up this project with an open mind. I knew perfectly well that the histories of Aaron Burr, by and large, have been written by his enemies, by the fans of Hamilton, whom he killed, or Jefferson, whom he got on the political wrong side of. And I wanted to see what this guy looked like really through the prism of his relationship with his daughter. And I will say this, that he was a devoted and very loving father. I have three children myself, and I think that anybody who's a good father can't be all bad.
H.W. Brands is Dixon Allen Anderson Professor of History at UT. His new book is called The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming in studio this time. Great
Delighted,
to have you.
Chris. I always enjoy the show.
If you have been calling into the show today, we want to thank you. We want to thank those of you who have emailed. We're sorry we didn't have time to get to everybody. We would ask you to make a call to support the station at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org. Now is your opportunity to make a contribution to the station. You can give $120 if you'd like and choose The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr as your thank you gift. It's a short book. It's actually about 175 pages, but a really interesting account of this person that you think you know from a very different point of view.
Yeah, it's a paperback original, I think is what they call it in the biz, and it's just out and available today with your thank you as your thank you gift when you join with a $120 contribution. If you've been thinking about becoming a member of the station, and you can swing $10 a month as a sustaining member, you can set that up either to come straight out of your bank account or right off your debit card or right off your credit card. You can do that, and we'll send you a copy of The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr by H.W. Brands with our thanks.
Our goal remains $18,375. We were hoping to get to that by 2 o'clock. It is possible. It will certainly only happen with contributions from a lot more people who are listening right now who might be waiting. Maybe you're waiting for someone else to do it. I mean, if everybody sits on their hands, we get nowhere. And if you are sitting here silently hoping that someone gives to KERA, maybe you're actually hoping that the someone is you. It just hasn't really processed that way yet. Maybe you've been waiting for yourself to realize, oh, wait, it's me. It's me they're hoping to hear from. Let us know that you care about KERA, that you want good radio in your community by going online now, making a contribution at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Certainly no amount is too large, but honestly, no amount is too small either.
Yeah, and if you're waiting for some sort of special offer or special deal, well, You get it every day when you tune in to public radio here on KERA 90.1. It is a special place. We do offer something special every day. It's virtually interruption-free, long-format reporting, storytelling, conversations that you hear every single day on KERA. A couple of times a year, we do these membership campaigns, and this one, it's lasted a little bit longer than we'd hoped. It's lasted a little bit longer than we thought. But, you know, really, ultimately, we're waiting to hear from you. And once we hear from you, then we know that we've got your support, and you know that we're not talking to you anymore. The number to call to do it is 888-694-6931. You can make your contribution at kera.org. You know, and when you make that contribution, you're also helping to spur others on to make their contribution, because the more of you that we hear from, the more efficient and more successful the station becomes, and people want to join a winning team.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can go online to kera.org. Thank you so much, Vincy Law in Dallas and Bradley and Jen Adams in Dallas. Really appreciate it. Perhaps they called for one of today's thank you gifts. We have My Two Moms by Zach Walls. Talked about that in the first hour. We have The Heartbreak of Aaron Burr by H.W. Brands that we just discussed. Both are available at the $120 level. And did I hear you say earlier that we actually have copies of the brand new John Irving book? John Irving doesn't even come on until next Tuesday.
Right. He's on next week. But the book, he was interviewed this morning on the Diane Rehm Show.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming through next week. So we're going to get to have John Irving here in studio. Hopefully interruption free. Hopefully we'll wrap up the membership campaign before next Tuesday when John Irving's here. But his new novel, In One Person, which is touted as a pretty provocative book. And I know you've been reading it, Chris.
I have been reading it. It is the first one since, I believe, Prayer for Owen Meany that is written in the first person. Mm. A lot of people are saying it's a return to sort of the John Irving that many readers knew and loved. You know, some people have sort of stuck with him through everything.
We're both big fans.
We're big fans. We've read it all. So I'm interested to talk to him. The theme is really interesting. You know, there's the classic Vienna and bears and a boys school and a missing parent.
I can't wait.
But the combination is really interesting this time. And it's very interesting because he's talking about human sexuality. And it's funny that it came up in a very different way in the conversation with Zach Walls, but this idea of being attracted to people and our power over that, or powerlessness, honestly, over that.
Well, we'll spend an hour with him on Tuesday, hopefully a full hour, if we can wrap up this membership campaign with your support. If you'd like a copy of that John Irving book, In One Person, you can get that with a $120 contribution today as well. We'd give you anything we could to get you to call 888-694-6931. I'd even give away my cool new pencil if you would call or go online to kera.org.
1-888-694-6931 is the number, or kera.org. So you may or may not choose a thank you gift. If you don't, you may be thinking, well, what is my money getting me? Well, you're listening to it, I would say right now, except this is not a great example. But when you listen to the news programming, when you listen to the entertainment programming, we know a lot of you are fans of Radiolab, you know, the sort of mm-hmm. clever programs that are on weekends. There are lots of options for pretty much every listener. Many of you we know have the radio on hours and hours every single weekday. Your contribution pays for the programming that you listen to. Nobody gets into journalism, or certainly public radio, you know, thinking, I'm going to get rich. Our plan for the money that you send us is about, sustaining the programming that you already listen to, and then thinking, how else can we serve you with this money? It really is, when we hear about any kind of, you know, bump in the budget, our first thought is, well, what can we do with that? What special projects can we plan to serve this audience?
Yeah, and you know, we do want to try to do more. Trust me, we're all doing a lot already with the funds that we're able to raise at KERA, and we'd love to do more. It's just a question of whether we can continue to be successful with a membership campaign like this. One person at a time is how we measure the success of these membership campaigns. And that's you, one you at a time. Your call to 888-694-6931, your online contribution to the station at kera.org, that's what makes the station work. That's what makes KERA a success. And that's really the crucial main thing. That's the main ingredient to what you hear on this radio station every single day. If no one contributed to the station, it simply would not exist. There's no way that we could bring you the programming in a market this size without individual support from you.
Maybe think about this. If you've been a sustaining member already and you're doing, say, $5 a month, couldn't you do 10? You haven't really noticed even 5 coming out of your budget. If you've been doing 10, how about 20? I feel like I'm running an auction right now. But you may want to think about adjusting that, giving a little bit more to KERA, this station that brings you so much now that you have tried the sustaining membership. You can do that as well when you call 1-888-694-6931 or when you go online to KERA.org. Your dollars keep the station strong. We know you don't have to give to the station. We do appreciate it, this contribution, not only to this station, but really to the intellectual vitality of the entire community. Your gift makes it happen at 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. Thanks.